It's to the best of our knowledge from PRX. I'm Anne Strangeamps. Does it ever seem like there are an awful lot of things to feel guilty about these days?
Are you failing to lean in at work? Falling short on your life goals? Backsliding on your diet? Feeding your family the wrong food? Imperfection is a terrible thing to live with. That's why, to the best of our knowledge, is offering a personalized 5-step program to finally fix your miserable, shoddy, substandard self. No more counting your flaws at 3 a.m. Don't settle for being a second-rate human being. Just fill out our online form, admit that you're inadequate, and give us your credit card information.
Okay, I wish we had a 5-step process to eliminate guilt because we could all use the relief. Wouldn't it be nice to stop feeling guilty about everything? Diet, exercise, work, money, relationships. There's always something we should be doing better. So how did we wind up in such a giant cultural guilt trip? Writer Devorah Baum has been wondering because she, too, feels guilty all the time. How soon after you wake up do you start feeling guilty?
Well, the question is whether or not I've got to sleep, really. There's a new book just about to come out by psychoanalyst Darian Leder. I think it's called Why Can't We Sleep? And his theory is guilt. He thinks guilt is always the answer. And I suffered insomnia for a very long time. So yeah, the moment the day breaks and I'm in it, guilt is with me. Yeah. What about you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's pretty much the first thought in my head is, what did I eat last night? And how many glasses of wine did I have with dinner? And I feel guilty about that. Followed by all the things that I need to do today that I haven't done yet. And all the things that I didn't do yesterday that I should have done. I don't know. What's your mental list?
It's not a list, I think. It's just an overwhelming sense that I'm in the wrong. It couldn't quite be a list in my case, because were I to correct any of those things, the correction would make me feel guilty too. So.
I'm curious about, you're married, right?
Mm.
Yeah. So my husband is one of those people who seems largely, to my eyes, free of feeling guilt. And he regards mine with a certain level of, I think, just kind of bafflement. I think he's sorry for me that I spend, perhaps waste so much time feeling guilty, but he just doesn't actually really know what it's like inside my head. What about your husband? Does he feel guilty too or not?
Actually, perhaps the reason I married my husband is he was one of the few people I'd ever met who didn't make me feel guilty. I sort of met him and I was suddenly able to feel things I haven't felt before, like anger, hatred. all towards him, I thought, here's a man I can really hate. I must marry him. Also, he told me he never felt guilty, and I felt this was something I could really help him to feel.
Oh, really? As opposed to feeling, oh, what a relief. At least when I'm in his presence, I can kind of give it a rest.
Yeah, but also I like to infect people who don't feel guilty with a little bit of guilt and, you know, desperately try to reassure people who suffer it as I do.
The self-help industry would argue that all this guilt is wasted, that guilt is just a wasted emotion, it serves no purpose. What do you think?
I think the self-help industry is fascinating. The number of books that basically promise you guilt alleviation. Jacqueline Rose, in her new book on mothers, says that there's studies that show that parents who read parenting manuals are more depressed than other parents. And it's not known whether it's the manuals who've caused that depression or if they were depressed and therefore they bought the manuals. But self-help manuals absolutely thrive on this idea of us as beings in need of correction. And we know that people who start buying self-help manuals are not going to stop anytime soon. They buy more and more and more and they're addictive. And guilt has that kind of inbuilt inflationary logic to it. And in German, the word Schuld is both debt and guilt. So it has that kind of accrual.
The thing that I don't understand about why guilt seems to be so widespread and so epidemic, as you said, is that we're living in this very secular age when religion has so much less influence on people's lives. And I think it was religion that really pushed guilty feelings on all of us for centuries. But it seems like we've got less religion, but more guilt now.
No, I agree. I'm always going to stand up for religion. For one thing, that story,
Adam and Eve,
it's not clear to me how we should read that story or that we should blame religion for sin. Religion has processes, rituals, ways of doing penance. To assume man is guilty and a sinner, I think is quite a relief. If the alternative in the sort of modern period is that we're not, we're just perfect. And we should never feel bad, actually. Because I think it's much easier to work in a system where you're not perfect, you're trying to improve, you're changeable.
So religion in that sense provided a wonderful psychological mechanism for assuaging guilt, right? Because you're a born sinner, but if you follow these precepts and these prayers and behave like this, you will be saved. So it's a path out of guilt?
I think it gives you relief and the possibility of seeing yourself as a work in progress that gets second chances and third chances and fourth chances through rituals such as forgiveness and penance, but doesn't have to assume that the kind of basic condition is that I'm perfect or that I should be and that anything else is a sort of wound. I find the modern model is one that's going to create a kind of necessary situation of a narcissism that's consistently wounded. I'm never on the side of guilt critics. In the modern period, what you had was a series of philosophers who promised to uproot guilt, who were fiercely secular, who blamed religion for guilt, saw guilt as the great chronic problem. So it begins, of course, with someone like Nietzsche, who's saying that guilt is what makes us weak and not noble, strong, heroic creatures because we've been forced to be bowed down and weak and degenerate in a certain way. And then Freud comes along and says guilt makes us terribly neurotic, and Sartre comes along and says guilt makes us inauthentic. And in the feminist tradition, you have it, you know, kind of critiques of guilt. But guilt isn't easily uprooted, and you certainly can't uproot guilt by pointing out to somebody that they shouldn't feel guilty. That's not the sound.
Sadly, yes.
Do you know what your problem is? Your guilt is useless. It's doing nothing. It's making you weak and authentic. Oh, thank you. That's really cured me. I feel much better now.
No, now you
feel bad at all.
Now you feel guilty about feeling guilty. I wanted to ask you about another form of guilt that's, in, at least in the States, shaping our cultural and political landscape, and that's liberal guilt.
Yeah.
I do feel guilty about my white privilege, my middle-class advantages. And at the same time, I think that that's really problematic. Like, I think my feeling guilty does not help anyone or serve any purpose. And it also seems selfish.
It does. And I think there's a cultural critic, an American cultural critic called Julie Ellison, who's written beautifully about this. She's very interested in the way in which the liberal who feels guilty is very often caught up in a kind of hysterical state. They're really not in control of their guilt. So even though the kind of critique of liberal guilt is suspicious of it, thinks of it as a kind of emotional manipulation, a way of drawing attention away from victims, back towards those who may not be perpetrators, but are really doing absolutely nothing to help.
Mm-hmm.
It's very often a mask for a kind of shame that is a bit more narcissistic, a bit more to do with the identity of the person rather than the thing that they have or haven't done, a cover story for that other thing. But I do want to hold on to guilt because it does suggest that the person imagines themselves as somebody who should be capable of something, of agency of a certain kind. So I never want to erase it, even if it is seemingly expressed in bad faith.
Devora Baum teaches English literature and critical theory at the University of Southampton, and her new book is called Feeling Jewish, a book for just about anyone. This hour, we're trying to figure out why so many of us feel guilty about so many things. So let's consider guilty pleasures. We've all got them. those things we love but feel like we shouldn't. And one of the most popular has been part of American culture for decades, reality TV.
What would you like to have happen?
All I care about is, like, saying yes to my mom, my sisters, and I feel like when it comes to the easiest thing,
We were still living in Iowa the first time Rob Kardashian broke down in a scene that had been clearly orchestrated for a breakdown. Family therapy held in what looked to be a vintage furniture showroom, complete with ornate velvet couches and fur blankets draped over mid-century chairs. Rob had on a black baseball cap, as would become the norm, presumably to hide the creeping baldness, and an oversized black hoodie to hide everything else. He grew increasingly upset at accusations flying his way. He began to tear up as the therapist coaxed him. "You look sad," then fled to the bathroom. His mother and two of his sisters, immaculate in dress and posture, stayed on the couch, stoic. Another sister and the therapist, and I would guess two or three cameras, followed him. The bathroom wasn't huge, so he was trapped, and the cameras were tight on him. The shot stayed mostly on him in profile, newly expanding torso heaving, the lightly stubbled beginnings of a double chin accordioning as he cried. He held a hand towel over his face, and there was that drama of watching someone so closely as they show you how little they want to be watched.
This is Lucas Mann. He's the author of the book Captive Audience, a portrait of his love for reality TV and the person he watches it with. His wife. And after listening to Halima Shah extol the glories of Bachelorette, Bad Girls Club, and Love and Hip Hop, we knew she was the perfect person to talk with him.
So, Lucas, why did you watch reality TV?
I don't know. You know, one of the things in thinking about the book, I think I had originally thought of it as just sort of like a look at current obsession or somewhat recent obsession, but it ended up going farther back autobiographically than I had anticipated, into sort of being very much of a generation to potentially be raised on this kind of entertainment. I'm 31.
From Universal Studios Hollywood, this is American Gladiators.
I realized that maybe my first memory of caring about TV was like watching American Gladiator reruns after coming home from kindergarten.
Malibu does get the first shot.
Whatever that sense of stakes was, however ridiculous the gladiators look, shooting giant Nerf cannons at each other, it felt like lived stakes.
Malibu reloads and takes them off balance again.
You felt like you saw people offering up some sort of maybe ridiculous over-the-top emotion, but still their emotion.
You're never going to defeat 220 pounds of twisted steel and sex appeal.
All right, so I want to get real here. You're a professor of creative writing. I work in public radio. We are not supposed to like reality TV, or at least that's what the perception is. How do people react when you tell them that you like reality TV?
There's a certain amount of derision, sort of eye rolling. And then also, I think now reality TV is so ubiquitous and there are people saying thoughtful things about it that there's the weird second layer of questioning of like, you're taking a low form and trying to identify that it's high or whatever. There's like a whole other kind of skepticism, which I think comes into play in the conversations that people have around The Bachelor and The Bachelorette as well.
Yeah, that's what I use to defend my taste in TV. I'm an anthropologist. I'm analyzing this.
Right. And one thing that I consciously wanted to do in the way that this book was written was not hold myself as a narrator with a cultural critic distance. And it was really important to me to write with the potential for my own embarrassment.
Bonjour.
This is the true story.
C'est une histoire vraie.
Seven
strangers.
Sept étrangers.
Picks to live in France.
In a chateau. Work together and have their lives taped.
The real world. Paris.
For me, I personally cannot watch reality TV alone. It feels like eating cake alone in bed. there's something weird and guilty and indulgent about it. But when I watch it with friends, I feel like I have some character, even though it's so over the top, to either collectively love or collectively hate.
One of the scholars that I write about in the book is a writer named Helen Wood, and she talks about these focus groups in sort of early reality TV watching, where people talked about their reality TV tastes with kind of a language of addiction. I know it's bad, but I can't help it. And I do think it almost, yeah, it feels like eating cake or even drinking, right? Where doing it alone somehow is this extra taboo, but sharing it and being able to have these pleasurable, but you feel ambivalent about it experiences with other people feels like way more of a permission.
Should we be feeling guilty? Should we be simultaneously apologizing when we're telling people that we like watching this show?
No, I don't think so. Again, sort of guilty pleasure feels kind of toothless ultimately. You're professing guilt, but then you're sort of going ahead and doing it anyway. But one of the things that, again, I think is interesting is that that way of experiencing and talking about it has been baked into the process of liking it forever.
So do you think that the producers of these shows, like The Real World or what I watch, The Bachelorette, consciously know that there's a lot of people who are being sucked into this, but they're not feeling too great about it?
Of course. Everybody feels pretty ambivalent about it. Hey, look, this is what it is. I don't feel great about it, but if this is what the masses want, give them what they want.
I want somebody who knows what they want to do.
Great. Then go find someone who have a mediocre life with.
I would talk to producers who would sort of frame their work as like, well, you know, what I'm interested in is shows that really sort of teach somebody how to do something, not that other stuff, not just people fighting.
Why does that mean I have to have a
Because I will give you an amazing life, an amazing life.
But you don't know what you want to do, Peter.
The conversation about how people feel about taking part in this thing and finding pleasure in this thing or profiting off of this thing is fraught for everybody involved. It seems like a pretty self-aware industry to me.
There was a point where you said that some of what you see on reality TV is genuine. I don't think I would ever assign the word genuine to anything I see on reality TV.
I don't know what I want to do tomorrow, because that is one day that means the rest of my life.
I think you can be both consciously aware of the artifice and skeptical, but also have these moments where it catches you with how much you are invited to think or do think that you're seeing some real intimate humanity. I don't think anybody watches something just to roll their eyes. That gets boring pretty quick.
So we have Donald Trump for president, a former reality TV star.
I'm looking for someone who's a problem solver. I'm looking for someone who's a sharp negotiator. I'm looking for the apprentice.
How much should we consider that when we're looking at him as our president?
First of all, let me say it's very weird to have a book that's being shopped around during that election. But I think that there's sort of a distinction, right? I think that what made him a particular kind of figure on The Apprentice wasn't just being a reality TV star, but very specifically being this sort of all-powerful judge.
Do you go around calling yourself white trash? Do you think I want to hire somebody that's white trash?
No. I say it as a joke sometimes.
I don't like it as a joke. You know what, Derek? You're fired.
He was the rare kind of reality TV star that explicitly was never questioned and nobody was allowed to fight with. He was only allowed to make judgments. And actually now his presidency far more closely resembles what an actual reality TV star like Kim Kardashian goes through. Not he is powerful, but he also is dissected constantly in the angriest and most petty ways.
Can you make the case for people who are skeptical of reality TV that they should watch Keeping Up with the Kardashians?
No. There's a point in the book where I did feel like I was actively trying to make the case for reality TV. And then I sort of got less interested in that. And it just sort of devolved into the sort of weirdness and the emotion of my own experience with it. You know, I have no desire to say that actually the Kardashians are the most important thing in the world. But I do think it is blanket written off more than any form of culture. And I think that that is sort of a dangerous and unproductive thing to do.
Lucas Mann teaches creative writing at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. And he was talking with Halima Shah. about his new book, Captive Audience, on love and reality TV. Next, it's one thing to feel a tiny bit guilty about liking trashy TV, but psychologist Tom Curran worries that an epidemic of guilt is brewing thanks to rising levels of perfectionism. He knows what it feels like.
I come from a relatively poor background, so I've always had a lot of imposter syndrome. I've always compensated for that by working overly hard to try and prove that people accept me in these sort of highfalutin academic spaces. I felt like I put a lot of pressure on myself and often felt quite bad when things have not gone as well as I wanted to or when I encountered setbacks. There's been times where that struggle and that stress has meant that I've had to take time off, that I simply couldn't go on.
More on why we feel guilt after this. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're trying to figure out why people feel guilty about so many things these days, and there's actually evidence that it's on the rise. Researchers at the University of Bath in England recently found that among young people, pressure to be flawless is skyrocketing. One of the study's co-authors, psychologist Tom Curran, calls it a hidden epidemic of perfectionism, and he says what's remarkable is that it really does seem to be generational.
I do think young people have entered a new world that has very unique social, economic, and political parameters that other generations didn't necessarily have to deal with. There's no doubt that expectations upon young people have increased, and there's a number of reasons for that. There's a lot of expectation now for students to do well in standardized testing, which is very, very important. This is how we set students and classify them and rank them. But the other one is social media, online platforms that emphasize perfection as an ideal that everybody should strive for. You know, things like Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, they're replete with images of the perfect life and lifestyle. And this is really reinforcing this idea that we need to be perfect, that we need to appear perfect. And that if we don't appear perfect, then somehow there's something deficient about us. And we think one of the ways that they're coping in this new world is to develop perfectionistic tendencies because that's how they derive a sense of self-worth.
This is sort of surprising in some ways because looking at the millennial generation, I would have said there's so much more accepting of what previous generations would have called social transgressions. They're accepting of alternative lifestyles. I'm just surprised that perfectionism would be worse than it was in periods of much greater conformity, you know, like the 1950s.
The big difference between then and now is that in the 1950s, there were still expectations of perfection. And we can think about the perfect housewife and all that emphasis on doing the right thing. But I think the difference today is that those ideals at some level were understood as things that we should look up to, but aren't necessarily obtainable. Whereas today, what I see anyway in my students is this idea that perfect lifestyle, I can have this if I just try hard enough, if I just strive hard enough. I think it's this idea that these things are obtainable is problematic because, of course, when they're not, that's when psychological problems start to occur.
Well, yeah, because then if you can't meet those expectations, you feel like you're a bad person.
Exactly. Guilt is very strongly associated with perfectionism. This idea that when we transgress, when we've done something wrong, or when we haven't lived up to perhaps other people's expectations, we feel bad about the act. And we feel like we have to put it right. And so we ruminate, we brood, we overgeneralize that transgression or act of wrongness to a defective self. And that's where things like shame start to come in, because shame's a bit like guilt, but instead of ruminating about a certain act, it's ruminating about how we're flawed as a person.
So shame is like one step up from guilt?
Yeah, I mean, shame is more debilitating than guilt, because guilt can have restorative properties, right? It can actually be a good thing to feel guilty, because we've done something wrong, we recognize we've done something wrong, and so guilt motivates us to put it right. Shame is really placing the blame squarely at the feet of ourselves. We have a defective self. And so shame and guilt, but shame in particular, is very commonly invoked by perfectionists. They feel a lot of shame all the time.
So what I hear you saying is that somehow we have managed to create a society almost perfectly calibrated to create high levels of perfectionism, which is then leading to an epidemic of feelings of guilt and, worse, shame. Is there something we need to do or change as a collective to break the cycle of perfectionism?
I think it's really interesting. In the work that we've done, we do imply that certain reforms that have occurred over the last 20 years are at least in some way to blame. Market-based reforms that basically took hold in the sort of mid to late 70s.
The doctrine of neoliberalism.
Neoliberalism, yeah. So this idea that the market is the only legitimate organizing principle of human activity, and you start to see marketized forms of competition embedded into social and civic institutions where they never used to be. So we see, as I say, we see standardized testing in schools, setting classifications, university league tables, you know, all these things never used to be here, but they are today, because these are forms of competition. This is the market. That puts pressure on young people, because now they're in a market-based society where every person for themselves. And what we're doing is we're forcing young people to focus on how they appear relative to others, how they perform.
Does that mean there's less perfectionism in the great social democracies, the Scandinavian countries?
What's really interesting is we don't have enough data from those countries, but the one region in our analysis from North America, Canada, and the UK, which demonstrated significantly lower levels of perfectionism, was Quebec. And Quebec has more of a social democracy, more of a European-style political apparatus. And so that's very telling, that there's something about that society that's providing some social resilience to what is an otherwise rising trend of perfectionism.
So we were talking about the 1950s, when there was so much culture of conformism, followed, of course, by the 1960s, a big pushback, a counterculture. Do you see anything like that emerging in the near future?
I think there is a lot of reason to be optimistic, actually. And actually, what's really interesting is young people are beginning to rise up and start to agitate to change what is a political and economic system that has failed them. And the popularity of Bernie Sanders in the US is a positive indication of young people becoming more activated and wanting to change what is a status quo. And even, you know, even the rise of Trump in the US, perhaps a silver cloud underneath all the negative things, and that's that people are reacting at an economic model that has been disastrous for vast swathes of people. So I do think there is a counterculture occurring, but I would also caution that we're probably going to see things get worse before they get better.
Tom Curran is a psychologist at the University of Bath in England, and he's the co-author of the first cross-generational study of perfectionism.
In the beginning, there was nothing.
If you want to tease out the origins of our obsession with guilt, you have to talk about the Garden of Eden.
God said, let us make humankind in our own image and likeness.
It's one of the foundational stories of Western culture and the basis for the concept of original sin.
God said to Adam, if you eat it, you will die.
Steve Paulson reached out to somebody who has been on this show several times, Pulitzer Prize-winning literary historian Stephen Greenblatt. He recently came out with this monumental book on the rise and fall of Adam and Eve, which turns out to be even murkier and more controversial than you would think.
You keep writing about key figures and transitional moments in our cultural history. Shakespeare, of course, and also the story of how an ancient poem by Lucretius was rediscovered in the Middle Ages and then helped launch the Renaissance. And now you have gone back even further to the Bible. Why are you so interested in the story of Adam and Eve?
The story is probably the most important, influential, imaginative creation in all of recorded history.
Even though it was only a page and a half in the Bible.
It's very strange. It is the key, or has been the key, to millions of people to understand themselves. Our dreams of bliss, our deepest sense of guilt and shame, our impulse to transgress, the origin of man and woman, love, sex, fear of snakes, mortality, you name it. It seems to be in the story, and it was central to so many people for such a long time, and still is.
And there are a few details that we all assume are in the story, like that it was an apple that Eve bit into, that the serpent who tempted her was Satan, that all of this was known as a sin, but none of that is actually mentioned in the Genesis account of Adam and Eve.
That's true. Genesis account is extremely reserved. One of the things that's amazing about the long life of the story and the story of the story is that people have longed to understand things that aren't made explicit in the story itself. Why the snake was saying what he was saying, what people's motivations were, obviously why the catastrophic decision was made to violate the prohibition, and so forth and so on. But each of these things has been opened up over and over again for now millennia.
So let me just say that the story of Adam and Eve actually has never made sense to me. I mean, given the opportunity to taste the tree of knowledge, to know good from evil, of course people would want that knowledge. It would seem inconceivable that they should not have their eyes open, that God would want people to live in blissful ignorance. So why would God forbid Adam and Eve to have this knowledge? I mean, does that make sense to you?
The fact that it doesn't make sense to you, Steve, and to me, is part of what makes the story so powerful and disturbing over such a long time. If it were perfectly transparent, as it seems at first that it is, I think that the story would have had a much shorter shelf life than it's had. God tells the first humans that they must obey a prohibition lest they die, but he doesn't explain what death is. How could they know what death was if they had lived in a world in which death had not yet been experienced? And then, as you said, the prohibition has a deep paradox built into itself. The prohibition keeps you from knowing the difference between good and evil, but it would seem like it's only if you know the difference between good and evil that you'd know that you should observe a prohibition.
I mean, I get that God wants to be obeyed, that that is central to his command, but what he's asking, if you do this forbidden thing, you will have knowledge. That's the piece that I don't get. Why would God want humans to not have that knowledge?
Well, you might ask, and you'll be in a long line of people who have asked that question. What we know is that the earliest surviving trace of the story dates from thousands of years ago, at least 2,500 and probably 3,000 years ago, but the first surviving trace is from about 2,000 years ago, the so-called Nag Hammadi codices, discovered in 1945, but under the sands in Egypt. And those say that it must be the woman who's the hero of the story, or possibly the snake, because the God who says that you shouldn't know the difference between good and evil might be a God whom you should disobey, a bad God. In any case, you couldn't possibly know for sure. Now, of course, the reason it's found below the sands of the desert is someone buried it, because that interpretation clearly lost out.
That was heretical, is what it sounds like. You weren't supposed to say that.
But what's heretical and what's not heretical? These are the people who lose arguments. But the fascinating thing is that the arguments existed, as far as we can tell, all the way back.
Yeah.
And that's what makes this whole thing so compelling and strange.
And then the whole idea that this was the original sin, that all of us ever since have been atoning for that original act of disobedience by Adam and Eve. I mean, that is a lot of moral weight to pin on this one story.
It is indeed. And that very phrase they've used, original sin, is a fairly late development in the thinking through of the story. It comes from St. Augustine in the 4th and early 5th century. Before then, there are lots of people who didn't think that that's what the story was suggesting. There are debates about this too.
So there are a few pivotal figures in this history of how the story of Adam and Eve has been interpreted. Another one, skipping ahead a number of centuries, was the 17th century poet John Milton, who wrote Paradise Lost. And the thing about that story is that he made Satan a really interesting character. I mean, the romantic poets later thought that Milton's Satan was actually the hero or the anti-hero of the story.
Yes, it's true. There are a handful of people who make the story swerve in a new direction. Augustine was one of these people. Milton is another.
What did Milton bring to the story?
Milton is able to get Adam and Eve, and really especially Eve. That's the wonder of Milton, that he gave the human beings at the beginning of time a marriage that they had never had before, a relationship. What's it like to live with somebody? What's it like to get up in the morning with a spouse and plan your days, to receive guests, to make a meal, to make love? And then he came up with the incredible idea that there was tension in that marriage in paradise. They have an extraordinary marital argument. It's that marital argument that led to Eve's going off by herself before the serpent approaches her. People had worried about this question. The ancient rabbis worried. Why was Eve alone when the serpent first spoke to her? Milton comes up with a completely different idea, a remarkable idea. Eve has the extraordinary thought that they should actually separate for a couple of hours during the day. They'd get more work done. They wouldn't distract themselves with trivial conversation. And then they'd meet up again for meals. And
a lot of married couples can relate to that.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary notion. Milton teases out then the meaning of this idea, because Milton deeply believed in the necessity of human freedom. Adam says very movingly, finally, go, for thy stay not free absents thee more. Go, for thy stay not free absents thee more. How deep that is as a perception of we feel about the people that we love the most.
Yeah.
We can't chain them to our sides.
Yeah. You know, the other thing that all of this makes me wonder about is how we might imagine what paradise is. It's really hard to at least wrap my head around that idea. Before they fell into sin, I mean, they lived in paradise. And what would that even mean in today's world? I mean, could we imagine what paradise would be?
We try to imagine it on our vacations. That's the whole point of, I suppose, of Hawaii and lots of other places that we designate as our
Is it just getting away from our daily concerns? Is that paradise?
It's something about abundance. It's something about the daily grind being suspended. But when we experience it ourselves, we experience it as a momentary relief from the ordinary. But what would it have been like to live in such a world where there was no vacation from your vacation?
For some people, that would be hell. Seriously.
I think Milton thought it would be hell, in fact, and that's why he thought he took seriously that God said that they were supposed to take care of the garden. So he thinks of them as having to labor. The ancient rabbis thought that they would want to study most of the time. People project onto this world some dream that they have of what life would be like if you had it absolutely the way you wanted it. You know, when I started working on this, I could only write this book when I realized that this is an enormously powerful story and has been so for several thousand years as a way for human beings to try to understand essential aspects of their lives. And it, in that sense, stands for the way in which the human imagination serves us. You need this as part of our inheritance to understand and think through questions of human responsibility, for example, or transgression, or love and fear.
Their eyes were open, and they knew they were naked, and they were ashamed.
That was Stephen Greenblatt, a literary historian at Harvard and author of The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve, talking with our own Steve Paulson.
They tried to hide from God,
But how could they hide from him?
Next, we take guilt a step further and look at remorse in its most consequential context, the criminal justice system.
There was a very high-profile capital case, a woman named Carla Faye Tucker a few years back.
Every choice we make affects somebody else's life.
She killed two people with her boyfriend over a motorcycle. She was on death row in Texas.
There should always be a place for mercy.
At her trial, her demeanor was under a lot of scrutiny. Her lawyer told her, just try to look very professional. And the next day, the newspapers reported that she looked arrogant and cold and remorseless. So her lawyer said, well, maybe try to be a little warmer the next day. So the next day, she went to court and saw her father in the courtroom, and she waved to him. The newspapers reported that she looked flirtatious and remorseless.
God's given mercy. I mean, he's given it so abundantly.
She seemed like she had found God and was sincerely remorseful and had become a really different person.
Not even near the same person.
She became a born-again Christian. She spent quite a bit of time accepting responsibility for the losses of the lives she took.
God forgave me.
I have sought guidance through prayer.
It was made very clear that her behavior and change of heart on death row was completely irrelevant.
Judgments about the heart and soul of an individual on death row are best left to a higher authority.
I'm not afraid of dying.
You are, if you're a defendant in a situation like this, in a performance that you can't opt out of. She was executed.
Next, why remorse matters and how we judge it. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. In the criminal justice system, feeling regret about breaking the law matters. Juries and judges want someone who's guilty of a crime to feel remorse, and they look for signs of it. But how would they know? Susan Bandes is a scholar in criminal procedure and civil rights, and she studies the intersection of emotion and the law. Steve Paulson talked with her.
So, Professor Bandes, why does feeling guilty or remorseful matter in criminal sentencing?
Well, that's actually the million-dollar question. I'm not sure whether it should or not, but everybody thinks it really does. The public thinks it does. The media thinks it does. Judges think it does. And jurors think it does. And they also all think that they can determine whether somebody is remorseful or not.
Why shouldn't it matter? Don't we want people who've been found guilty to feel remorse? Isn't that partly what this whole process is about?
We punish people partly to send a message that what they did is something that's going to lead to consequences and that they shouldn't do it again and other people shouldn't do it again. That's deterrence. We also punish people for retributive reasons, which is, you know, you did a really terrible thing. You should be punished for that. Remorse doesn't play an obvious role in either one of those questions. If we're punishing you for what you did, the way you feel afterward isn't necessarily relevant to that. I think the most relevant aspect of remorse for punishment is it's kind of a rehabilitative idea, right? If you're remorseful, then you're either you want to become a better person, or you might be saying, I did this awful thing, but that was totally out of character for me. That's not really who I am.
Part of the reason why we want the criminal to show remorse is once they get out of prison, if in fact they do, you know, they would seem to be less likely to commit another crime.
Everyone really believes that a remorseful person is less likely to commit another crime, but there's absolutely no evidence that that is true. I'm not saying there never will be such evidence. I'm saying that I've scoured the current knowledge on this, and there is no link.
Really? That's so surprising.
I know it is. It's very surprising, and judges and juries certainly don't think that.
So when judges and juries are trying to figure out whether someone is guilty or how severe the sentence should be, they are looking for remorse. I mean, that factors into their judgment.
It's huge. Well, so, for example, there's a Capital Jury Project, which is this amazing, ambitious project that interviewed many, many jurors after they had determined life or death in capital cases. These jurors were interviewed, and they said that remorse was either one of the three most important factors, or in many cases, the most important factor in determining whether they were going to sentence somebody to life or death. But remorse takes time. Remorse isn't necessarily something that you feel even by the time you've gone to trial. True remorse and true atonement, really thinking through, is this the kind of person I want to be? Can I be a better person? That's not just a fleeting emotion. That's kind of a life change. And yet the law doesn't really care what happens to you once you go to prison.
And there's also the question of whether the person is actually feeling remorse or just putting on a good show of appearing remorseful.
Yes. Is the law really capable of determining whether someone is feeling it and evaluating it? And there we have some other folk knowledge that turns out to be quite inaccurate. It is not possible to look at somebody's facial expression and body language while they're sitting in a courtroom at a trial and determine whether they're remorseful. Not only jurors, but judges are absolutely sure they can do this.
Is the defendant also making eye contact with the jury? Probably all that figures into it as well.
Very much so. There was this one study out of some state court judges in Connecticut, and they were asked, do you think you can tell whether a defendant is sincerely remorseful? And a majority of them said, oh, definitely, I can do that with a high degree of accuracy. And the question then was, well, how can you tell? What do you look for? And half the judges said, well, if the defendant looks me straight in the eye and makes eye contact with me, then I know he's remorseful. And the other half said, if the defendant is looking down at the floor shyly and with humility and not looking straight at me, then I know he's remorseful. Remorse is especially hard to evaluate across cultural lines or racial lines or ethnic lines. Some Canadian judges were telling me they had for years been judging people remorseless when the defendant wouldn't look them in the eye. And then they went to a cultural competency training workshop where they were told that Aboriginal people culturally had been raised to think that it was quite rude and aggressive to look someone in the eye.
Hmm.
And this judge had this epiphany that he had been giving people a sentencing tax for doing something based on his own cultural ignorance. There's a study by Bill Bowers and his co-authors. They studied juries and they found, for example, white jurors would look at a black defendant and find him arrogant and cold, and black jurors looking at that exact same black defendant would find him remorseful. So remorse isn't a thing in the world. It's a communication, and both sides of that communication have to have the same rules in their head about what it's supposed to look like.
Is feeling remorse the same thing as feeling guilt?
No. Well, let me say, first of all, that I think all these emotion terms don't have a fixed, widely agreed upon definition. So the important thing is doing what you're doing right now. Like, let's talk about what definitions we're using so we're not talking past each other. Guilt, I would say, is an internal feeling probably that people have. It's also a legal judgment, but I don't think that's what you're asking me about right now. Remorse, in most definitions of it, requires a little bit more than that. Not just that you feel bad about what you did looking backward, but it has a forward-looking component also, which is I didn't mean to be that kind of person. I want to be a better person in the future, and I want to make atonement. So there's a forward-looking component to that as well.
So you've looked at all this research, which it sounds like very few judges are aware of. Juries obviously are not aware of that.
Right, right.
How would you change the criminal justice system based on the evidence that you've seen?
I think a few things can happen. One is exactly that we need to instruct jurors, not only on if we want them to think about remorse, then let's talk about why. Don't assume, for example, that this is a recidivism issue. And let jurors know that facial expression is really not the window into the soul that so many of them seem to think it is. So we can instruct jurors about that. We also, by the way, have to let jurors know that under the Fifth Amendment and our presumption of innocence, people really shouldn't be required to prove their own innocence. And, you know, this is a sort of uncomfortable moment there, too, where prosecutor might say, well, he never said he was sorry. He really doesn't have to say he's sorry. And finally, expert witnesses are another really important thing. So, for example, mental illness or mental disability can lead to lots of different ways of showing or having difficulty showing remorse. And judges are probably not going to have the kind of knowledge to know how might autism or schizophrenia or bipolar disorder lead to a particular difficulty showing remorse.
You're not saying remorse doesn't matter. That does seem to be a factor in making them better people.
Right. It's a really hard question. If you look at, you know, recently we all watched Larry Nassar in the Michigan State case.
Right. The sexual abuse cases.
Yeah, exactly. The gymnast case. Certainly appearing to be extremely unremorseful. And it was very hard to watch. It, you know, made people very angry that he wasn't expressing remorse. Now, that really is galling, right? And we care about that. And the question is, how should punishment reflect that? I think that it's hard to take remorse off the table entirely when you're evaluating somebody's future in the penal system, because it seems so tied in with a lot of other things we care about, like empathy and just a basic sort of sense of humanity and the ability to learn from one's mistakes and grow. And I think part of what we're saying here is that when you're in a courtroom and your demeanor and your actions are being evaluated, it's hard to nail it down to just one or two factors. We do tend to look at the whole person. I don't think we can totally avoid that, but I do think we can give people more guidance. Let's not operate solely on folk knowledge. Let's not put this guy away because you think he's less remorseful and therefore he's likely to recidivate when there's no evidence of that.
Yeah, it's really complicated. Thank you so much for walking us through all of this.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Susan Bandes is a professor of law emeritus at DePaul University. She's written extensively on the role of emotion in the law, and that was Steve Paulson talking with her. Hey, if you like this show, do us a favor. Subscribe to the podcast. We would really like to build a bigger online audience, and we could use your help. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Halima Shah, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Mark Rickers. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.